Hello, and welcome to the Points in Focus podcast. I'm Jason, and this is episode 7. For once, I'm going to be talking about cameras and not just random stuff related around photography. Specifically, I'm going to be talking about one camera, the Canon EOS M3. Incidentally, I will probably be talking about cameras again next week, as it's expected that Canon will have announced the EOS 5D Mark IV by then, so it'll be 2 weeks of cameras and not random photography-related stuff. So, the EOS M3. Well, it's not a new camera. So this isn't, you know, some great, oh, everybody needs to run out and check out this new camera. The M3 was announced in February of 2015, so it's a year and a half old at this point. And while it's not a new camera, it is a new camera to me. I just got one. In fact, this is being recorded basically 3 days after I got mine, so it's not a review. It's a first impressions podcast. I am working on a detailed review of the camera. It's going to be an article on my site on pointsinfocus.com. It's probably going to be long because that's how camera reviews that I write end up being, because, hey, modern digital SLRs are far more complicated than just click, there's a picture, and you're done. So, with that said, let's jump into the M3. Now, I want to be upfront about something. This is not I'm not advocating a position on this camera. I personally like this camera. It is not the best mirrorless camera on the market in abstract terms. It is not necessarily the best choice for any given person for a mirrorless camera on the market. There's a lot that goes into choosing a mirrorless camera, choosing a camera. There's a lot of factors, and it's not, I would argue that this isn't something that can just be boiled down to like, it's got the highest dynamic range or the lowest noise, or it's a full frame camera or something like that. Cameras, digital cameras as a whole, have gotten to a point where technologically they are good enough for the vast majority of anybody using them, including professional photographers. The numbers differ. There are definitely cameras that have more dynamic range and less dynamic range and so on and so forth. But the cold, hard, simple reality is, having, say, 2 stops more dynamic range or 3 stops more dynamic range at ISO 100, which is basically what a Sony camera has compared to most Canon cameras, doesn't help you if you don't shoot at ISO 100. If you shoot at 800 or 1600, where the cameras are within spitting distance, that extra dynamic range doesn't matter. But even more beyond that, if you're not using it, it doesn't matter. That if you're taking a picture, if you're not taking a picture of a great subject or compelling subject, and you don't have a compelling composition, and so on and so forth, that any of that extra dynamic range or better noise performance is not going to make your picture better. And likewise, if you're taking a picture of a really enthralling subject and the color and the composition is there and it is just reaches out to your audience, people viewing it, grabs them by the heartstrings, it just pulls them in, it really won't matter that you don't have 2 stops more dynamic range. That's not going to ruin the picture. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is it's very important in my experience to, while numbers are there, numbers are great, there's a lot of other factors that go into, like, what should you care about when you're buying a camera? And things that I find far more valuable to me when I'm buying a camera in terms of looking at are things like the user interface, the support, the way it integrates, like if you have other cameras, how this new camera will integrate with your system. You know, if you're a professional, what are the professional services for the camera brand like? It's ancillary. It's other things than just how many stops of dynamic range or how much noise does the picture have at ISO, you know, 10 million, or does it even have ISO 10 million? I mean, you know, the D5, Nikon made a big splash. It's got 3.2 million, ISO 3.2 million in, you know, expanded mode. And, you know, like I've said to other people, well, yeah, but if you don't shoot at ISO 3.2 million, having ISO 3.2 million doesn't really matter at all. So the EOS M, or the M3 specifically, what I'm getting at is this isn't something that maybe any given person will want or care about. That it's I'm not trying to sell you on the camera. That there's a lot of factors that are involved in wanting or what makes this make sense for me or not make sense for you or make sense for you, that kind of thing. Where I come from on this. So when Canon was basically dumping EOS M's, the original EOS M in 2013 or so, that they weren't selling in the United States, and the strategy appeared to be from Canon to just get rid of the cameras. Dump them, get them out of store shelves. They were going for like way less than what they sold for originally or when they were first released. Get them out there. That it's cheaper to take the loss on, was more effective or whatever for Canon to take the loss on the cameras and not have to worry about stock and inventory and support and parts and all that stuff that's associated with them. And they were cheap, and I picked one up. And I won't say I fell in love with the camera because the camera had a lot of issues. But for me, it was an interesting camera, an interesting option to have. I mean, I wasn't giving up my 5D or 1D for the EOS M, but having it as a, you know, take when I go, you know, when I'm doing something with the family on, you know, holiday or something like that, instead of pulling out the big SLR and a big 24-70 2.8 and a big flash and all of this stuff, it was handy to have a little camera. And I'm biased to Canon. I freely admit that. A major part of my bias to Canon comes down to their user interface, the way they lay out their controls, the way the controls operate, the way the camera operates as a result of the controls and so forth, just clicks with me. It always kind of has. It's not something that's, you know, I it's not like I can't use a Nikon camera. It's just, it's harder for me to use a Nikon camera. They're not as intuitive to me. That, you know, again, that's it's a personal thing there. It's a personal preference. And I'm not saying that anybody should agree with that, because you should go with what works well for you. So the original EOS M, cheap, Canon, intuitive-ish to me, or at least I expected it to be. And of course, it natively mounted with, you know, I mean, obviously you had to have a glassless adapter, but it would natively communicate with all of my regular SLR lenses. Downsides, no EVF, you know, that kind of thing. It was kind of really a lot more of a pain in the butt to operate that camera than I sort of expected it to be. But I picked up, at the time, there was only two lenses, a 22mm f2 STM lens and the 18-55mm f3.5-56 IS STM lens. So I had those two lenses. The 22 f2 I really liked on the camera. In fact, I continue to struggle with the thing that really I like on these cameras, both the original EOS M and the EOS M3, is I want F2 primes. I want a 10mm, a 16mm. I've got the 22mm. I'd like a 30mm F2. I'd love a 50mm F2. and I'd like something like a 60 or 65 millimeter F2. I'm sure there's a lot of people that would say, oh, well, you know, a F1.8 or F1.4 would be better, but F2 seems to be like the right compromise in these cameras for size, that they don't have to be super big, but and speed, that you get a nice fast aperture. Depth of field, because it's a crop sensor, F2 gives you the equivalent depth of field on one of these cameras as an F2.8 lens does on a full frame camera, or at least it's very close. So, like, the 22 F2 would be equivalent to a 35 F2.8 in terms of depth of field and field of view on my 5D. So, you know, I really would like to see Canon come out with more primes for these cameras. It's a really nice way, to work with these cameras. So, anyway, the M3. Canon made a massive pile of updates and changes and just took the flat brick M and turned it into something that's an absolutely serious user capable camera. The M had all kinds of shortcomings. There was no command dial, or like you have on an SLR. There was the dial on the back, but it was hard to work because it's kind of off on the side. You had to touch screen through a lot of things to, you know, switch between ISO and aperture and shutter speed, or ISO and aperture, or ISO and aperture, or shutter speed and exposure compensation. It wasn't just a, you know, real, like, where Canon's SLRs, you have the higher end ones, the ones I'm used to, 5Ds, 1Ds, you have a primary command dial, a secondary command dial, and that is your, like, if you're an aperture priority, that's your aperture and exposure compensation. You don't have to go dance through, you know, holding buttons to get to other things, and you certainly don't have to dance through, like, tapping the screen to change options. And the physical controls make the camera faster to use, which is, it sounds sort of like, well, why would I want the camera? I want the camera to be faster to use because it, or maybe faster is the wrong word. A better word would be more efficient. It makes it more efficient. You don't have extra key presses and extra strokes and extra buttons and extra things that you have to mess with. You just have a dial. Click, click, click. Settings changed. The original M, none of that stuff. Everything was basically soft, with the exception, I mean, they had the multi-controller dial for changing the settings, but to get to the setting, it was basically soft. On the M3, Canon has elevated. The mode selection is no longer a touch screen, it's a physical dial. Exposure compensation is no longer a touch screen, it's a physical dial. The aperture, the shutter speed, the exposure program, exposure line, you know, whichever one it ends up being, is no longer something you have to do through the touch screen. It's a physical dial. In fact, the camera has three dials on it. It's got a primary command dial, it's got the exposure compensation dial, and then it's got the multi-controller dial on the rear of the camera. And what's absolutely amazing to me in some respects is the EOS M3 is closer in many respects to the kind of interface that you would have in a professional Canon SLR than any of the Rebels, the Power Shots, you know, the professional or the higher end Power Shots, the original EOS M, the M2, the M10. That this is, you've got a primary and secondary dial. If you're shooting, say, in manual mode on the M3, your shutter speed and your aperture are on physical dials that you can just click, click, click and set. Exposure compensation is on a physical dial. So if you're shooting in aperture priority, shutter priority, or program auto exposure modes, you have the physical dial around the shutter release for your aperture, your shutter speed, or your program line, and then you have a exposure compensation dial, plus or minus 3 stops and 1/3 stop increments, on the back of the top of the camera, top plate of the camera, that you can work with the side of your thumb, basically. And, I mean, this is the kind of interface that I am used to in a professional SLR. This is a fast, efficient, usable interface for kind of pretty much any kind of, you know, photography that you could do with this camera. Now, yeah, that was a huge thing. Next huge thing is they added a grip to the camera. It's not a huge grip. It's the smallest grip of any Canon camera, you know, pretty much interchangeable lens. Well, with the exception of the, you know, the original M, the M2 and the M10, which basically don't have a grip, but it's not a huge grip. It's not a great grip, but it's enough of a grip that you can curl a finger, you know, you get your fingertips around it and you don't feel like you're going to drop the camera. At least I don't feel like I'm going to drop the camera. I can put, with a mount adapter, a big heavy lens like the original 24-70 f2.8L, and the lens weighs 3 pounds, 3.3, so like almost a kilogram, with big heavy lens, and I can put that on this camera, and with the grip and the electronic viewfinder option, which is also a huge improvement of not having it, and I'll come back to that in a second, but I can put that lens on with the mount adapter and I can shoot with this camera and I don't feel like I'm going to drop it every second I'm holding it. That it's a massively more secure feeling, and secure feeling makes it a massively more comfortable feeling. And that's with a big lens. With a little lens like the 22 F2, it's not even comparable, and how much better it is compared to the original EOS M. It's so much just more comfortable to hold, more secure to hand in your hand, in my hand to hold. So that was second big upgrade, elevating the physical dials to first upgrade. Second big upgrade was elevating the having a decent grip on the camera. And, you know, those two things help whether you're using the optional EVF add-on or if you're just shooting it with the LCD. And I've done it, you know, I've used the camera both ways. The EVF is better, in my experience, if you're putting an EF lens adapter, you know, an EF or EFS lens on the mount adapter on this, because they're bigger and heavier and that extra point of contact makes everything a little more stable. But I've shot both ways with even, you know, relatively large EF zooms. I had my 16-35 F4L IS on here on the mount adapter, and that's not an insubstantial zoom, and that was still comfortable for me to hold and operate because of the grip and the dial and the way you could work the camera without having to kind of like precariously balance it to get to the little dial multi-controller on the back. Okay, EVF. It's an optional add-on. Now, I will admit that it's really expensive. It's $180, $190, something like that. I got a tremendous deal on this. B&H had the camera with $200 off, and if you bought it with the EVF, you got another $200 off on the cost of the EVF. So basically, I got the body, the M3 body, for $10 less, the body and the EVF for $10 less than the body alone. This is almost back to kind of, I don't know if this is being dumped or if this is just kind of a deal that was going on or whatnot, but this is almost back to like the kind of crazy pricing the original M was seeing when Canon was just trying to get the product out of inventory and get rid of it because they weren't really going to do EOS M's in the US anymore. It was a tremendous, I thought it was a tremendously good deal, like I said. I also think the camera needs the EVF. Not always. There's obviously a lot of times that you can get away with not having the EVF, but it's a much better experience with the EVF as far as like going and taking pictures. EVF. That it's kind of, I would say in some ways, it's kind of a really necessary, well, for me, it's a necessary add-on to the camera. And then, so the whole package with the EVF and especially like the 22F2, but really any smallish prime is really, in a lot of ways, to me, feels like a poor man's Leica. That Leicas, I've never owned a Leica because, a Leica M, I should say, because they're ridiculously expensive. Leica wanted like $7,000 for their first digital M. The lenses alone, you know, they're all, pretty much all of them are primes, and they're all way north, you know, of a couple of grand. And as much as I thought, you know, as much as I would have liked to have played with them, that's way more money than I was looking at ever spending on that kind of camera. But there's a sort of a prime lens on a small, quiet, unobtrusive camera is a fantastic tool for shooting like street photography or candid grab this kind of image in an event or at a family gathering or a party or whatever. That the prime lets you visualize, you very quickly get a feel for what will be in the frame because of the prime, and so you already are kind of seeing the world the way the camera is going to see the world, and then that lets you compose a picture before you even pick the camera up to take the picture. And then the small unobtrusive camera, and this is also where the fast F2 lens comes in handy, but the small unobtrusive camera, and you can just pick it up and click and put it down and kind of move along. And, you know, I think that's a fantastic thing that you can do with the M3 and the EVF and, you know, like the 22F2. And it's a kind of, in some ways for me, because I'm used to shooting with a big SLR and a big F2.8 lens, zoom lens, in some ways it's actually kind of liberating to shoot that way or to work that way and not, you know, have this huge camera and this heavy camera, you know, that is hanging around my neck. The other thing, too, with the EVF, well, is if you're doing that kind of thing, and you're using the rear LCD, that kicks off a lot of light, and that can kind of be obtrusive. Whereas with the EVF, you can set the camera up, so you have two options. You can either have the camera set up so that you can manually toggle between the EVF and the rear display, which is what I find myself using pretty much all the time. Or the EVF has a eye detection, you know, a proximity detection sensor that, when you put it up against your face, it'll turn off the main LCD and it'll turn on the EVF. And it's good in theory, but what I find is that it's kind of slow. It's not as responsive. Canon uses a similar face detection or proximity detection sensor on their Rebels to turn off the rear screen when you put the camera up to your eye, so you don't get the glare from the screen, and you're obviously not looking at the screen, so it's not using power. And that works much faster and much more efficiently than the way this works, because it doesn't have to switch video from one display to the other. So I work this with the manual thing. It's usually on the EVF mode. If it's in manual switch mode and the EVF is what's selected, it doesn't even turn the rear display on, which is great. It keeps it nice and dark and isn't getting, you know, throwing light and picture and stuff in people's faces and eyes. And, you know, that whole thing is a nice thing. It's also a really nice touch. So the rear screen on this, let me touch on that real quick. The rear screen on this, it's articulated. It does 45 degrees down so that, you know, if you're below the camera, you can look and the screen will tilt down 45 degrees and then it tilts up 180 degrees. So you can see the screen from in front of the camera. And to me, this is, again, one of those things that, okay, the articulation on the screen, I don't think, it doesn't feel to me like it's the strongest articulation mechanism I've ever come across. It feels almost a little flimsy. However, if you're a content producer and you do like YouTube videos or something like that, about photography, but even about, you know, anything else, being able to flip the screen over so that you can, when you're standing there looking at the camera, you can see what the camera's seeing. It may not be perfectly clear. It's obviously a little tiny screen, but you can see that your head is in the shot, that you're not going to, you know, be, you're not out of frame. You could see if you're trying to frame something, you know, on a table or something like that, you can see what you're doing. It works great for that. It also works great, like, if you're trying to shoot with the camera on the floor or the camera above your head. Again, you can see what's going on, what you're doing. So I like the articulated screen. I really hope that Canon brings the touch and the articulated screen into pro SLRs. Obviously, the mechanism would have to be different, but the ability to rotate the screen so that I can be in front of the camera and see what the camera's looking at, or I could point the camera at something like low or high or on the ground or whatever, and rotate the screen so that I have the best angle of view, the best view angle on the screen, is a great thing. And, you know, I'm not, this isn't the first camera I've used with a rotating or an articulating touch screen, or either articulating or a touch screen, but it's just another point. I mean, for the most of the time, I leave it closed and in the standard, you know, flat on the back position. But the option to have it to move it is really nice to have. The other thing that Canon added, that's sort of a big external thing or whatever, is there's now a pop-up flash in the camera. The EOS M, the M2, and the M10. Like this one, have a hot shoe. It's compatible with all of Canon's flashes, but there's no internal flash. I take that back. The M10, like the M3, does have an internal a pop-up flash. It was the predecessors, the EOS M and the M2, that didn't have pop-up or built-in flashes. And okay. So the first thing that every guide for photography says is don't take pictures of people in dark rooms with pop-up flash. The room is dark, the people become bright, and it's just people on black. And, you know, all those guides, they're right. That isn't a great picture. And you can do much better if you do something else than take that picture. However, if this is the only time that you've seen your best friend that from college that you've lost touch with, or that, you know, was going to war, or, you know, going to be shipping out to Antarctica for 6 months or something like that, and, you know, this is your opportunity to have a picture with him hanging out at the bar or something, your favorite bar or whatever, the whole what's going to make the best picture versus having a picture is far more important. And if the picture being a bright person in a pitch black room is the picture that gets you that memory of hanging out with your best friend, that's better than not having a picture, in my opinion. And this is where that pop-up flash comes into play. It's not a great thing to have all the time. And you're not going to always want to use it. You're probably not going to want to use it a lot, at least if you're going for good pictures. But with, like, the EOS M, I had to carry a little tiny pocket flash that I could put in the hot shoe and then have that pop-up flash capability. With this, it's built into the camera. I don't have to worry about having another flash. I don't have to worry about the AAA batteries in it running out and dying. I don't have to worry about a whole slew of things. I just hit the switch on the side of the camera, the flash pops up, and I can take a picture. Even as a serious photographer, where on camera, on access, flash is not a desirable thing pretty much any time. The flash has flash exposure compensation. It's not a fixed power flash. I can knock the flash down two or three stops and use it as a real soft or real low power fill flash to bring up shadows in people's face, add a nice catch light to their eye, that kind of thing, because again, it's in the camera. I don't have to forget it or, you know, worry about that I forget it at home. Did I forget it in my, you know, do I have it? Is the batteries charged? You know, and doubly so with the EVF, which plugs into the hot shoe. If I've got the EVF on, I can't use a pop or I can't use a regular Canon speed light anyway on the camera. So, you know, there's that. Having a pop-up flash, at least on this kind of camera, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. Would I want a pop-up flash on my 5D? Not really. Would I want a pop-up flash on a 1DX? Not really. Even on my 40D, where I had a pop-up flash, I basically never used it. It was there in case I needed it, but I never really used it. I had an actual speed light to put on the hot shoe. Same thing I'm probably going to say is true with this camera. I may never use the flash on this camera other than just to test out, see how it works. But it's there if I need it. And this is not the kind of... This is a much more casual camera for me, the way it uses, the way it presents, than my SLRs. And because it's a more casual camera, I'm less concerned about flash power. I'm less concerned about bouncing off a light or controlling third, you know, off camera speed lights or any of that kind of stuff. It's a little bit of fill if I need it, or to pop, you know, a picture that I couldn't otherwise realistically take. So that's the pluses. What are the minuses? I have a couple. They're not huge. They're not things that I find to be like deal-breaking, game-ending, don't really want the camera if I or wouldn't have bought the camera if I knew this going into it kind of things. But they are little frustrations that I think Canon could have done a much better job of smoothing over. Start with the battery. The M3 uses the new LPE17 battery. It's also used in a couple of the new Rebels, the T6i and T6 or whatever they are. I don't remember off the top of my head. The original M used the LPE12 battery. And so what's the difference? Well, the LPE17 had 20% more capacity to the battery compared to the LPE12. The 12 is about a 6.2 watt hour battery. The 17 is a 7.5 watt hour battery. That's a pretty big deal. I mean, I would not want to be shooting with this camera with the LPE12. You'd get significantly less pictures. You'd get significantly less runtime when you're shooting video, that kind of thing. However, I would have really liked it if Canon had made the LPE17 an extended version of the LPE12, by which I mean, instead of basically changing all of the dimensions so that this battery was completely incompatible or the camera was completely incompatible with the older battery, I would have really, it would have been really nice if Canon had kept the dimensions the same, except for maybe the thickness. And, you know, what do I mean by this? Well, the LPE12 measured 32.5 millimeters by 12.5 millimeters by 48.5 millimeters. The LPE17 measures 33 millimeters by 14 millimeters by 49.4 millimeters. So it's half a millimeter wider, it's a millimeter and a half taller, and it's about a millimeter longer. Now, the taller, yeah, I'm not so, you know, they could have, I think, made it even a millimeter taller than that and still kept the capacity and so forth while maintaining the other two dimensions. But the result of this is, like I said, I have an EOS M. I have two batteries for the EOS M. Yeah, they're not as big as the battery for the M3, but they're completely useless. I can't put them in the camera and use them. I could understand the LPE 17 not being back compatible to the M because it had to be physically bigger to have the higher capacity. But the other direction going forwards, not being able to use the LPE-12 and the M3, I fully accept that if I was using the LPE-12, the smaller, older battery, that I wouldn't get as many frames and I wouldn't get as much recording time and so on and so forth. But on the same token, if I already have the batteries, you know, and I might have multiple of the batteries, it would be nice to be able to use them instead of basically having to throw them away. Well, okay, recycle them now. I really, you know, would like to have been able to just run with it. Second niggle, or complaint, is Canon, for the last, well, basically since 2006 or 2007, Canon has been adding more and more customization to their cameras. I am a huge proponent of allowing people to customize their cameras. Yeah, it does mean that if I'm a Canon user and you're a Canon user and I pick up your 5D and you pick up my 5D, we might not know what all the buttons do because my buttons do something different than your buttons. And, you know, there's on a sort of hand the camera to somebody else basis, the fact that the buttons could be changed, could be different, it makes it harder to do that. On the other hand, I don't necessarily use, or I don't really hand my cameras off to somebody else. They're my cameras, I use them, and my objective 9 times out of 10 is that my camera be as efficient for me as I can make it. And that means being able to put controls on the camera where I need them, when I need them, or, you know, where I need them and where they're fast and efficient for me to use. So customization is a great thing. Canon offers right now basically 2 options in terms of customization on the M3. It's not all that much different from the rest of their SLRs, but this is what's on the M3. Option 1, you have what's called the My Menu. And it's basically like a landing page on the menu, you know, in the menu system where you can put 6 of the most frequently the most frequently used things, or the things you use most frequently in the menus on the My Menu page. And then you can set the camera so that anytime you hit the menu button, it starts you in My Menu instead of wherever you left off the last time in the menu system. On Canon's, or at least on the SLRs that I have, the 5D Mark III, the 1DX, and the 1D Mark III and the 40D, I can pick any setting, custom setting, menu option, anything in any of the menus, and put them on my menu page. And on a camera like the 5D, I have things like the viewfinder grid that you can enable or disable, because I don't always want it in the viewfinder. I have mirror lockup. I have sensor cleaning. I have whether I'm mirroring the rear LCD over HDMI, or if I'm sending a clean video feed, because sometimes I want to do one and not the other. And then finally, this is one, the big one for me, is I have my format card there. One of the things I've always really liked about Nikon's SLRs is they have a nice format command system. You hold the delete button and the mode button on the camera, and that formats the card. You don't have to go dig through menus. Canon, you have to go dig through menus, or you put it on the My Menu page and then you menu format. Yes. On the EOS M3, the format card option is not something that I can put on my menu page. I have to dig through menus to get that to it. And I don't understand why. Now, maybe some of this is coming from the fact that I'm coming to the EOS M3 from a higher tier user perspective, so I'm not afraid of accidentally doing something, or I'm not afraid of my camera. And Canon is targeting this as a thing for, you know, more novice, lower tier users, and by not having format card available for the My Menu, maybe their thought process is, well, then it makes it harder for somebody to accidentally delete the pictures on their card. Of course, the format process is still the same. You hit format, and then it asks you, are you sure you want to format? Defaults to cancel, so you have to scroll or touch OK, and then it formats your card. So I'm not really sure where or what the thought process was for that, but it's something I miss. It's something I find a little frustrating in the My Menu configuration. The second customization option is that buttons can be programmed on the camera. And so in the case of the M3, there's basically, there's three buttons you can reprogram. And the buttons are the multifunction button, which is right next to the shutter release, the delete button, which is basically down on the multi-controller scrolly wheel thing, and the video record button. If you kind of like want to give up video recording capabilities, you can reprogram the video record button to not record video. And like other Canon SLRs, what you can program to these buttons is it's a limited subset of commands that kind of are what Canon's decided is best for you to be able to use. And this is, again, one of those places where I find things frustrating, because you can't, some of the, for me at least, the vast majority of the commands that Canon will let me program on a button are commands I don't really care about programming on a button. Like, I can make a button switch between RAW and JPEG. Well, I only shoot in RAW, so that doesn't really do anything for me. That there's no utility in that command or that function there. On the M3, the options are kind of even pared down and more limited than that. I have my multifunction button programmed to be depth of field preview. I have the delete button programmed to turn focus peaking on and off manual when I'm using manual focus, and I'm not even sure that's really useful. It might just be useful to set that to nothing from, you know, the given options. I have the movie record button set to record movies, because, again, with the way I use this camera as a casual camera, being able to just hit the button and record a movie clip of, you know, friends hanging out or my family doing something or whatever is far more useful to me than not being able to do that. And, again, like I said, this is one of the places where I find it to be a little frustrating that they give you this select limited set of functionality and, you know, you can take it or leave it, basically. Specifically, one of the things that I'd really like to be able to do with this camera is decouple the autofocus from the shutter release. On my SLRs, I use a technique that's called usually called rear button focusing, where half pressing the shutter release only turns on the exposure meter, and full pressing the shutter release obviously releases the shutter. And then if I want to focus, I have to hit the AF on button on the back of the camera. And what this lets me do, that methodology, is one, I can fire or refire the autofocus system quickly and easily. So if I lose focus, I can stop it and restart it and hopefully, you know, get focus back faster. But I can also use like continuous servo AF in a one-shot kind of mode. Like, I don't have to have the lens always servoing continuously, which, you know, like if I'm shooting something like, you know, wildlife where it's moving, but then it stops, or it's moving and then, you know, there's something else I see that is static that I want to take a picture of, or that kind of thing, it lets you very quickly sort of switch between the servo and the non-servo without having to mess with things. It also means that your lenses act like manual focus lenses until you hit the button, so you could work basically in manual focus. On the EOS M, I can't decouple that. Now, one of the reasons why I would want to decouple that on the EOSM is something that bit me the first day I was playing with the camera. I was out. It was after dark. There was a big thunderstorm on the horizon, and I was trying to take some pictures of it. And every time I'd hit the shutter release, the camera would start trying to focus. But because it was dark and because it was a low contrast situation, the camera couldn't focus. The sensor was too much noise. There wasn't enough contrast in the focusing algorithm time frame that it could, you know, do things, and the camera couldn't focus. Now I could manually focus on like a street light a long way away, because that was bright and there was contrast and the camera could pick that up. But I couldn't focus on the cloud. And so I would have to kind of, or I could autofocus on a street light because it's bright, but I couldn't focus on the cloud where the lightning was. So what I ended up doing, which fortunately is rather nice on the M3, is there's a dedicated manual focus button that turns off the autofocus system, puts the camera in manual focus. So what I ended up doing was to focus on the street light that was way off in the distance, but that I could focus on effectively, and then turn off the autofocus system so it wouldn't hunt. And I guess in some ways this is almost as good as rear button focusing in some respects, but not quite. Speaking of manual focusing, one of the things that was something I did real quick when I got my first M was run out and buy a cheap mount adapter for some old manual focus lenses I had, Canon FD mount manual focus lenses. And because of the short registration distance of these cameras, the M series cameras, you could mount pretty much any lens on the camera and, you know, run with it. Focus, obviously most will be manual focus. I'm not sure if anybody has a autofocus like mount adapter for other systems, but you know, it's possible to manual focus a lens on one of these cameras. On the M, it was a struggle, because there, other than the magnification option, there really was nothing in the camera that you could do to get a better view of how your focus was going. M3 sort of solves that problem. Now, it's not the best implementation I've seen, but it introduces focus peaking when in manual mode. And you've got a choice of colors, red, yellow, and blue. I'd like to have seen more colors, but, you know, it is what it is. You've got a choice of intensity, low intensity, or high intensity, and you get focus peaks on the highlights, or on the in-focus edges. They seem to be most of the time on the shadow edges, like if it's a shadow of something and not necessarily the highlight edges. I'm not sure if that's something I'm missing in terms of the way focus peaking is supposed to work, or if that's just Canon's weird implementation. But basically, I have mine set to blue. When something turns blue, it's in focus, or the edges of something turn blue, it's in focus. So, like I said, I one of the first things I did when I got my original M was I ran out and I got a focus or mount adapter for FD, Canon FD lenses, and I threw a 50mm f1.8 lens on the mount adapter and threw that on the camera and then put it away, because it was just a royal pain in the butt to do anything with that lens on this camera, on the original M. On this camera, the bigger problem, or the biggest problem, is that the FD 50 f1.8 just isn't the sharpest lens in the drawer, and the sensor at 24 megapixels and 1.6 crop is really demanding. And while it kind of works, it's kind of not the best solution in terms of image quality, but it is something that I can focus. It does have that old lens feel, if you get, you know, if that's something you're interested in. And it is kind of like a different way of sort of working a camera. It's I've never been a huge manual focus user or fan. I've always preferred autofocus because it's faster than I am, and it lets me catch things I otherwise wouldn't catch. But for video, I've gone to manual focus a lot because you need to have that kind of control to get good video, so it's not like focusing all over the place. And with focus peaking built into the camera, that makes it kind of really easy to and effective to do that. So that's I'm glad Canon added that. I would like to see it improved. I think it could be better, but it is there and it does work, at least to the point that I actually have been able to use it, and I actually don't have a massive problem with using a manual focus lens on this camera. Except, like I said, the image quality issue. Speaking of image quality, I have been I've been shooting full frame since the 5D Mark III came out, so basically like 4 years now, I think it is. And before the 5D Mark III, I had a 1D Mark III, which was APS-H, so it was 1.3x crop, not 1.6x crop. So I've been sort of biased towards the full frame and the larger sensors in terms of image quality, noise, dynamic range, etc., etc., etc. Every time I've looked at Canon crop cameras, I've always found myself kind of going, you know, it'd be a nice camera, but it's still kind of noisy. And honestly, I even had the same reaction. I was helping a friend of mine get his Nikon D500 dialed in, and I kind of had the same reaction to that. It's a nice camera. It's not something that I would ever really, you know, like, I don't have a major qualm with it, but it is kind of a little noisy. And the M3 is kind of a little noisy, but I'm very surprised compared to my experience with other crop cameras how not a little noisy it is. Now, how does it compare against like a D500? Well, the D500 comes off better. It's not a D500. But it is darn good. I mean, you can go, I mean, if you wanted to, you can go to DxO Mark and you can compare it. And you can tell me, well, objectively, it's worse than this and this and this and this. Objectively, it's worse than my 5D Mark III, at least in terms of noise. And I don't care. It's about a stop and a third worse in terms of noise than my 5D Mark III. So I can shoot basically a stop higher ISO on the 5D Mark III. But in qualitatively looking at it in Lightroom, I really don't care. The noise just, it's not bothersome to me. It doesn't, that extra stop of noise doesn't put me off on the image. Again, I'm not doing a quantitative test. I've kind of shied away from quantitative tests of this kind of stuff, largely because, like I said, when I started, having a stop more dynamic range isn't going to make a bad picture good, and it's not going to ruin a good picture. So what I'm more interested in is how things feel and look, and especially like if I make a print, how the print ends up looking and that kind of thing. And you know, like I said, I'm pleasantly surprised. It's much nicer than the EOS M's 18 megapixel sensor was. It, at least visually, at least to my eye. And while I wouldn't say it's as good as the sensor in the 5D Mark III, it's pretty close visually. I mean, I know numerically it isn't, but some of that comes down to the higher resolution. The extra 2 megapixels makes the noise a little finer grain, so it's not as chunky or whatever. I'm not really sure. Like, I don't have a good handle on how to explain the feeling or the way the two cameras work. And I'm certainly not saying I'm going to dump my 5D Mark III for this thing. Actually, I want to dump my 5D Mark III for a 5D Mark IV. But in terms of, at least on my standards, and of course, this is the other thing. Like, I'm talking about my standards. My standards, how do they compare to anybody else's standards? That's, you know, I can't make that call that, you know, this is something, you know, every person who's evaluating a new camera or a potential new camera has to figure out on their own is the picture going to be good enough for them? But at least by my standards and my feeling and my experience, I would certainly be happy with the pictures that I can get coming off of the sensor in the M3. You know, like I said, probably not as good as, or not quite as good as the pictures coming out of the sensor in my 5D Mark III, and I certainly can't keep up in autofocus and frame rate and burst size and so on and so forth, but for candid stuff, shooting at ISO 3200 or 6400, you know, family gatherings or something like that, the pictures would certainly be more than usable on web resolution sizes, more than usable on like a phone screen or a tablet screen size. And I would say probably up to like 1600 usable as a pretty good size print. Like, I haven't printed anything with this. Like I said, again, not an in-depth review yet. I just don't have the experience with the camera, only having had it for 3 days. But the image quality I'm seeing in Lightroom of some test pictures strongly implies to me that if I was at, say, 1600 and I was in Alaska like I was a year ago, I could take pictures of waterfalls or whatever, glaciers, and I could make prints, and the prints would probably be from typical viewing distance and where I've hung prints. The prints would probably look just as good as the prints that I got off of my 5D Mark III. Of course, a lot of that comes down to, you know, our vision kind of sucks. And if you're 4 or 5 feet away from a 12 by 18 inch print or a 13 by 19 print, hey, you're not going to see the detail that is or isn't there really well. But in terms of, you know, like what I'm seeing of noise and solid color areas and that kind of thing, it's again, it's not as good as the 5D Mark III, but it's close enough that I won't say it's visually indistinguishable, but it's close enough that I'm not annoyed or bothered by it in my stuff. So, like I said, sort of a preview, first thoughts on having some hands-on time with the EOS M3. I really like this camera. Again, not a replacement for me for a big SLR, that kind of thing, but it's a fantastic little camera as a sort of companion camera, as a casual camera, as a street photography camera. I think it would be great. I would have no problems doing like landscapes with this, with the one exception being, or the one caveat to that being, there's not a tremendous amount of prime lenses. The lens selection, the native lens selection, is still somewhat lacking. I would really like to see Canon do something about that sooner rather than later. And I think if Canon got to doing some lenses, the viability of the platform would be higher, or the interest in the platform would be higher. Because when there's not a lot of lenses, there is a lot of potential for people to look at it and go, well, there's not a lot of lenses, and I don't know if I really want that. I also, like I said at the beginning, I'd really like to see Canon target do a series of fast primes. I really, like I said, I'd like to see Canon do something with, like I said, prime lenses, fast prime lenses, covering, you know, the equivalent focal lengths of what you would have from like 16 to 105 millimeters or so on a full frame camera. That's the classic range for Leica rangefinders, and it covers most general shooting, street photography, documentary photography uses. And you know, again, being fast, it makes them decent, you know, for low light stuff. The crop sensor adds about a full stop of depth of field. So for an equivalent angle of view, an F2 lens would be equivalent to an F2.8 lens on full frame. So, you know, there's that kind of going on. And, you know, I think, you know, if Canon really wants to sort of distinguish their crop, or they're not distinguished, if Canon really wants to sort of carve out a nice niche for their mirrorless cameras in their sort of overall product line, the place I'd like to see it, or the place that I think it could do well, is as sort of the professional photographer's lighter camera. Not necessarily a replacement for the 1DX or the 5DS or the 5D or that kind of thing, but as a, I don't want to say like a replacement for a Leica, but in the same kind of niche, the same kind of use space, usage cases that you would use a Leica M rangefinder, you could slot in one of these, you know, a Canon guy could slot one of these in and go with that. And if it's not tremendously expensive, I mean, I consider Leica's rangefinders to be prohibitively expensive, but $500, $600 for one of these bodies, or $400 if they're, you know, doing the rebates, which is really great, $450 or whatever. But, you know, like I said, I would much rather take this and go do street photography in the French Quarter in New Orleans or whatever, than take a 5D and a big lens and so forth. It's just the pictures I'm seeing right now. And I mean, I may change my opinion on this down the line, but the pictures I'm seeing out of this right now, I won't say rival my 5D, but they're good enough that you could make, I could make solid content driven, you know, like I said, if the subject matter grabs the viewer, the quality, the technical execution is not as important. And, you know, with a camera like this, I could go do that kind of thing without being a super intrusive and super, like, you know, aggravating to people, not the guy with the huge camera that's getting in everybody's face, that kind of thing. It, you know, or the quiet kind of camera that just, you know, is, it's, I think it's a, like I said, I like this camera. Yeah. So, like I said, start of the podcast, next week, I'm probably going to be talking about the 5D Mark IV. No, I won't be getting my hands on one anytime soon, but I will have, you know, some thoughts on it based on anything that is published that I can get my hands on. It ends up, I've done this basically every time Canon's released a, you know, new major SLR, sort of a here's where I think the good things are and here's where I think Canon dropped the ball. And I'm going to be doing probably that as a podcast, I think, next week, assuming the camera gets announced when I think it's going to be announced, or when the rumor mill indicates it's going to be announced. I'm also working on a long-form review of this. It's, again, going to be probably huge and a lot to read, and it's going to go up. It's text. It's not going to be a podcast or anything like that. I also will probably be revisiting this camera in a podcast form in a future episode after I have a lot more hands-on time and I've actually gotten to take it and go shoot something serious with it. I'm not sure what. I have no idea right now, but, you know, have it in a more field, field use case type thing. And then I'll at least be able to verify what I thought was good or not good, or whatever turned out to actually be good or not good. So, EOS M3, I like the camera. I'm not saying anybody else has to. I'm not saying anybody else should, but I like it. And I have run incredibly long, but I hope this was at least an informative, rambling podcast. So thank you very much for listening, and until next time.